The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Is it or is it not fantasy fiction? We're not talking about a Game of Thrones spin-off, but about Kazuo Ishiguro's latest novel, The Buried Giant, which has kicked up a stink on both sides of the Atlantic with its evocation of a post-Arthurian land strewn with Roman ruins and stalked by ogres and dragons, across which an elderly couple must travel to find their long-lost son. The grande dame of fantasy, Ursula K. Le Guin, no less, laid into him for his perceived slighting of genre fiction in a newspaper interview. But Ish was having none of it, as he told a Guardian Live audience.
You've sailed into a bit of a storm with it immediately, haven't you, with the fantasy community, with particularly Ursula K. Le Guin getting very irritated by an interview you did with the New York Times, in which she thought you appeared to be saying you hope people didn't read it as fantasy because you didn't take fantasy very seriously and you thought that might alienate them. It wasn't actually what you said, but that was her take on it.
I did say the last bit that you just said. I was quoted, and yeah, this is a quote through an interview in the New York Times. I was quoted saying, I hope people won't be prejudiced against the ogres and the pixies. You know, maybe people will read it as fantasy. I didn't say because But, I mean, I have to make it clear, if there is some sort of battle line being drawn, you know, for and against ogres and pixies, you know, appearing in books, I'm on the side of the ogres and pixies. I have to make that absolutely clear. I had no idea this was going to be such an issue until I published this book, and I went into it quite innocently. Maybe you know more about this than I do, but as far as Ursula K. Le Guin is concerned, I think she's a little bit hasty in nominating me as the latest kind of enemy for her own agenda. This is what I suspect. I mean, I think she's very quick off the mark to restart some argument she had with Margaret Atwood. This is my
Does everybody
reading.
Remember the argument with Margaret Atwood around the time of the blind
Because she references this in whatever she wrote, that she 15 years ago or something, she felt Margaret Atwood was sneery towards sci-fi. I think genre walls should be porous, if not non-existent. I must say, I don't like people who fortify the walls between genres. I think 10 years ago when I wrote Never Let Me Go, there was a similar kind of question: is Never Let Me Go sci-fi? You know, is it or not? And I was actually nominated for the Arthur C. Clarke Award, and I went along to the prize ceremony. And I was, it was an incredibly warm bunch of people there, and they seemed slightly surprised that I had turned up, and they were very grateful that I turned up. But it did feel very odd that it was like a different community. It was like I turned up in some different planet, you know. And they were terribly grateful that I wasn't sneering at them. I was longing to get this prize. But I think the sci-fi thing has become, even in the last 10 years since I published Never Let Me Go, I think it's come much more into the mainstream. You know, the younger generation of writers, people are writing their first, second novels now. It's not exactly instinct, but I mean, it's certainly something they feel is an option. The dystopian, the speculative setting, the alternate reality device. You know, all these things, in a very exciting way, I think the younger generation of writers, from David Mitchell younger, you know, use all these things with relish. And so I think that if there was a stigma about sci-fi, I mean, it's faded rapidly. And I hope the same thing will happen with fantasy. I don't want to see any of these kind of silo-like barriers, you know.
Neil Gaiman reviewed it, and he said something interesting about fantasy. He was saying fantasy is a way of making metaphors concrete, and it shades on the one hand into allegory and on the other hand into myth. And I just thought, you've got both allegory and myth playing in this novel. Particularly, there is a dragon, Skerrig, who does or does not spread the mist of forgetfulness that's gone over the whole land. And I was thinking, what does Skerrig mean? What the secret of this novel will be discovering who's what Skerrig represents.
She's called Quérig.
Sorry, so Quérig.
What does it mean? I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but I mean, it might give an insight into why. It's an example of why I needed to use what you might call fantasy techniques or fantasy tropes. I mean, for a long, long time, I had an idea for this novel. As far back as 2001, I remember describing this novel as the next novel I was going to write to an audience. But I couldn't quite get the last bit of the jigsaw. And, you know, I had many things in place. All these things we've just talked about, you know, societal memory, the role of shared memories in a long marriage, when is it better to remember, when is it better to forget, and all these things we just talked about. But how could I create a situation? So I needed to create a situation where this kind of oddly controlled amnesia had spread over a whole community. So how was I going to do that? And so that became one of the main questions for me. And that had direct implications on what kind of world and even what kind of genre, if you like, you know, that this book would fall into. And I tried various things. You know, I could have come up with some, I suppose, kind of sci-fi solution. Yeah, I mean, we can all kind of dream those things up, you know. But in this particular case, I felt it was better to be kind of slightly mythic, you know, old-worldly. It should be some sort of mist. I saw the Britain at that time covered in mist. You know, it'll be just moorland and, you know, not even hedges and fields, and just moorland and featureless landscape. Quite frightening for people. You know, they don't, if they move out of their communities, goodness knows what's out there. You know, what kind of supernatural forces are at play out there? I mean, it seems to me that it'd be very natural if you lived, even logical if you lived in that time, in that kind of environment, to believe in all these strange things. And so I thought, yes, let's have a mist that has been placed there, perhaps for some kind of political reason, but we don't know this yet. It's been very deliberately placed there to make people forget certain things. And as we go on, we realize that, you know, it's there to make people forget some awful violence that occurred a generation before.
So go on, talk more about this dragon. I'm interested to know what the
dragon?
Yes.
I can't tell you too much about the dragon because, I mean, you don't see the dragon until the end. You know, it's kind of, the dragon is, this is a bit of a spoiler, but the dragon is the source of the mist. But, you know, you'll find that out about halfway through. You know.
But you do and you don't. I mean, in a way, it isn't a spoiler because you never do really find out, do you?
Yeah, I think it's fairly clear. Well, maybe you didn't find out. I know most people, I mean, most reviews just I mean, I'm not so coy about telling you now because most reviews have said that anyway. They say, there's a mist that made people forget and the source of it is the breath of this dragon. But then, you know, I needed a plot situation where you have this question, you know, is it a good thing to get rid of this dragon, or is it better to leave this dragon alone so that some sort of peace, however much it's founded on something perhaps unjust and violent, at least, you know, as long as a dragon is alive, you know, and people suffer from this kind of amnesia, you won't restart the cycle of violence again. You know, things won't degenerate into more bloodshed. There's a chance, perhaps, that if, like a sticking plaster, things will heal of its own before the plaster falls off. But, you know, the peace that's been enforced is itself getting old and exhausted. You know, it can't hold for very long. And I think that's the nature of many kinds of peace in history and in our contemporary world as well. Often the peace is enforced, or it's not founded on a real consensus or the consent of the people who are being asked to coexist. And sometimes you just remove the strong arm and all at the top, and all hell breaks loose. Yeah. So, but why are you so interested in the dragon?
I'm interested in the extent to which it's an allegory, because it isn't quite an allegory, is it? Because it's not a simple, straightforward equivalence.
No, I'm not quite sure what allegory means. I'm not a very clever ing-lit person, so I don't quite know strictly what... And so I might be wrong about this, but I always think an allegory, you know, there has to be much more direct correspondence. You know, like, I'm more leaning towards metaphor and myth. You know, I'm trying to... I want people just to read this story for what it is. I don't want people to spend their time getting distracted by saying, oh, does this stand for Bosnia, or is this Milosevic, or is this General de Gaulle here, or is this a reference to this learned kind of, you know, ancient text that I remember from my university days? I mean, you can do that if you want, but, you know, I'm not nearly that clever, so this isn't going to... the story is there. I'm offering it for what it is, and it should be fairly obvious how it's applied to contemporary situations. It's not just to, as I say, to kind of civil war situations or countries that have just come through trauma. I mean, South Africa being another good example, I think, of where they've balanced the remembering and forgetting very, very deliberately to avoid, miraculously avoid civil war, I think, after apartheid. But I think you can look at much more stable countries like this one or United States. You don't have to think for long before you find, you know, buried giants in those societies that continue to cause great unease.
If we go a little bit into the actual way that you write, one of the things that I noticed that I thought was fascinating was that there are a few times when you say, it's a beast, but, oh, it could have... Gawain slays a beast, decapitates a beast, and he says, oh, it's nothing more than a big dog. And right at the beginning, Beatrice goes up and gives some food to a stranger, and all the women of the village say, oh, she must be a demon, and Beatrice says, no, she's just a woman. And I found that fascinating. So you're playing with the idea that actually the superstition is actually the creation of fear, and it might actually be that dragons are big dogs and demons are old women.
One of the ways in which I like to create worlds that are slightly removed from our normal reality is by just tweaking the level of surprise that the characters in the book feel towards events that occur. They do react, but they don't react in the way that we would. They might be slightly surprised, but they're not surprised enough. And I think that's a... You can control the level of realism or reality in a world very subtly by keeping a control on what is actually extraordinary in the fictional world and what is more or less everyday and what is something in between. And so I don't really go for, you know, having extraordinary things happen, everyone saying, oh, yes, that's normal. I rather like an odd thing to happen and for people to react just a little bit, but not quite as much as we would. Because that's a very... I think that's a much more subtle way of just kind of distorting things. And so both of these instances that you've mentioned, I mean, you know, if we saw some sort of phantom ghost dog, you know, whatever is described in that book at that moment, you know, we would freak out. In this book, they are alarmed. You know, they don't want to meet this dog. They're pretty, you know, they face it as something that's pretty hazardous. And they're pretty afraid of it. But they don't respond in quite the way you or I would. And, yeah, I mean, Gawain is just trying to... It's a bit of bravado, really. I mean, he's saying, ha, yeah, I can deal with this. You know, I've met much worse than this. I mean, it's just a big dog, isn't it? I mean, but... And the same with the other example you cited there. I'd like to do that, but rather than have it as completely normal, that, you know, weird things turn up. I want them to acknowledge this strangeness. I want them to have some kind of fear, but not as much as we would have, because they're used to their superstitions. My rule of thumb in creating this world was that if it's within the imaginative range of the average inhabitant of this world, in a pre-scientific superstitious society, and in the very early days of Christianity, if it feels kind of not eccentric to believe in sprites and pixies and demons, you know, the idea that when you walk out there into this kind of very hostile, dark, uncivilized stretches of swathes of land where, you know, there's no roads, there's nothing, you know, it seems to me perfectly reasonable to believe in these things. You know? But if it's beyond their average imaginative world, it couldn't happen in my world, you know. So I couldn't have a flying saucer land in the buried giant because because these kinds of people would not have it within their imaginative realm.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, a powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
So much for my questions to Ishiguro. But what else did the audience want to know?
I found it very interesting what you said about our tendency to hide certain feelings and forget certain feelings in order to make our lives easier, because it's easier that way. And how, in a way, we're therefore living in a fantasy or not living in reality. And was that one of your motives for using fantasy figures to show that there is this fine line between fantasy and reality, and that's why that these fantasy figures were welcome in your novel?
I hadn't actually thought about that before, actually. I know in common parlance, we would often say about someone who's kind of very self-deluded or someone who is deceiving themselves to an enormous extent, we would say that they live in a fantasy world, you know. It's a very interesting thing you raised there, because it hadn't quite occurred to me before. I'm not quite sure that if that's why I have resorted to fantasy tropes. I don't think that is really why in this particular case. I don't think, you know, the ogres and the dragons are there to signify that people have actually escaped from a harder reality because, you know, they couldn't face the harder reality and they've retreated to the world of ogres and stuff. I mean, I think in this world, the ogres and the pixies are real. You know, that is the real world. And they stand for very real things. When they appear, and they don't appear that much, but they appear for pretty kind of real reasons. You know, that the scene when the pixies turn up, you know, it's about a near-death experience. It's about what, you know, it's about watching somebody very dear to you nearly die and all the kind of emotions you go through. And you try and fight these pixies off this person, and they just keep coming. And and because they're weird pixies, you know, they're maybe putting a spell on you, saying, you know, try not to get too emotionally attached to this person because they're going to go anyway. You know, why don't you just go away and leave this person to us? And you're saying, no, go away. So they're there for very, very real reasons. You know, so I think when I've used the fantasy tropes, that I've used them for precisely those, you know, that really difficult, hard reality moments. So I don't think in this case there is a parallel, but I think that's a very interesting idea of that you've just expressed there. And I wonder if, to some extent, if this is why some people are slightly suspicious of the fantasy genre. They think it is some sort of retreat away from reality into something that is self-deluding or is escapism of a shoddy sort. And as a genre, it represents a genre of escaping from the hard realities of life. You know, I wonder if that is one of the reasons why the fantasy genre can get stigmatized. But I also think it raises quite an interesting fictional possibility that, and I'm sure, you know, Claire is much better read than I am. I'm sure you might be able to think of some examples where people have indeed used fantasy tropes to orchestrate someone's retreat from a world that they couldn't bear anymore. Actually, I've just thought of one, Pan's Labyrinth, the movie Pan's Labyrinth, I think is exactly that. You know, it uses fantasy to show a world that is so that the girl can escape to because the real world is so unbearable.
First of all, thank you very much. I first became aware of you when I studied you at UEA and studied Remains of the Day at UEA, and we got into great debates in our classes about what actually happens in the Remains of the Day, a little bit similar to the gentleman upstairs. Do you mean to allow a lot of scope for your readers' imaginations within your works? As a reader, I feel you do allow a lot of scope. Is that purposeful or is that my interpretation?
Well, it depends how much scope you're talking about. I mean, I don't like my novels to kind of dictate to readers, you know, how they should be feeling at any given point, or even in terms of, you know, everyday things like description. I don't like to describe too much because I think people tend to carry around sort of lots of images in their heads anyway. So I prefer to just try and just put in one or two details. And I, you know, because I think the kind of a cinema in the reader's head is kind of very powerful. And I just need to kind of provoke, you know, turn on a few little switches. And I kind of feel that to some extent about the larger parts of my novels as well. But having said that, you know, I do have a fairly precise idea of what I want people to take from my books. You know, I do want certain emotions to be conveyed. I mean, the reason I write these novels, essentially, I've realised, is that I really want to share emotions with people. You know, I don't want to just make people kind of weep over a kind of a weepy scene or something. I want to share quite complicated emotions about certain big situations, you know. And I'm saying to people, I would feel this in this situation, which I think is quite a big part of human experience, you know. Do you feel it too? If I put it in this way, if I express it like this, don't you feel what I feel? You know, the emotion I feel coming off this, surely you feel it too, don't you? And sometimes people say no, you know. But sometimes people say yes. And for me, that's a very valuable thing that I get out of reading other people's books. You know, it's been a very important thing for me to read books by writers who are around now, but also writers who are around hundreds of years ago, and to feel that you know, there's an exchange of emotions, and that people felt things like that in those days. And I've been profoundly grateful to not just authors, but filmmakers and musicians for having allowed me to kind of sort out my own emotions about something. So they've kind of ordered things for me. And so when I'm writing a book, I do want people to feel a certain set of things at certain moments. And beyond a certain point, I'll say, yes, if you got something completely different from what I intended, then I would feel I had failed. I do go along with, you know, the reader is never wrong, the customer is never wrong kind of attitude, you know. In the end, you know, the book is the book. If people take something out of it, you know, that's what they get out of it. I'm not going to blame them for taking something else out of it. But if a lot of people are getting something completely different from what I intended, then I would feel disappointed. Even if they were raving about the book and saying it's a fantastic book, but it wasn't what I wanted them to feel, then I would feel that I would feel disappointed, you know, because I am trying to do something very, very specific.
I think that's all we've got time for today. Thank you very much, Kavya, for coming along, and thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And that's all for this week. The Buried Giant is published by Faber. If you have anything to add to the debate, and if you've got this far, I'm sure you probably do, please leave your comments on the podcast page, which you can find on guardian.com/books. You can also find there our recent book club discussion with Ishiguro on the remains of the day. And do join us for upcoming Guardian Live events, including a talk with Philip Pullman about the staging of his Grim Tales at London's South Bank on March the 30th. For now, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Eva Krishak, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.